Hi, this is Blair Hodges, host of the Old Fair Podcast. I call it the Old Fair Podcast because we're making a few improvements by branching out on our podcasting offerings. In an effort to provide material more often, the Fair Podcast will soon include transcripts and recordings of various Fair Conference presentations, as well as shorter apologetic vignettes for your listening enjoyment. I'm leaving those expansions in the hands of others, but I'll still be hosting interviews on religious issues with a variety of scholars. My interview episodes will be called Fair Conversations. In this episode of Fair Conversations, I'll be talking with Kevin Christensen. Kevin, who is a technical writer in Pennsylvania, is a good example of what Hugh Nibley acclaimed as the Day of the Amateur. Kevin has published over 20 articles in the Farms Review. He's presented at numerous Sunstone conferences and published in Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. And recently, he co-authored a piece in a book from Oxford University Press called Joseph Smith Jr., Reappraisals After Two Centuries. That book was edited by Reed Nielsen and Terrell Givens. Kevin joins us today to talk about his own experiences with LDS apologetics. Questions or comments about this and other episodes can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Welcome to another episode of the Fair Podcast. We're here with Kevin Christensen. How are you today, Kevin?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. I wanted you to sort of introduce yourself a little bit, give us a brief background of who you are and how you got involved in Mormon studies.
Well, I grew up in the church. I grew up in Bountiful, Utah. I graduated from Viewmont High School and went through seminary and was active in church and a very active family. Everybody going on missions all the time, but I didn't really get involved too much in the intellectual side of things. I got a testimony in my third reading of the Book of Mormon just before my mission, and I was reading Ether 1239, when he says, and then shall you know that I have seen Jesus face to face, and he spoke with me in plain humility as one man speaketh to his friend. That just really powerfully hit me. I felt like that really happened. And that what that meant, Jesus was real, that he'd been resurrected, and that Moroni was a real person. And then on my mission, I went to England and started running into people for whom the gospel was not as obvious as it was to me. And that was just an ongoing question. I started to wonder about that. Why is it that we can be looking at the same thing and have a completely different experience? And started collecting scriptures that eventually, led to things like that. But it was on my mission that when I was working in the Morecambe, which is near Lancaster, and I was a district leader for a few months up there, and we had some elders up in Kendall and went up to Kendall to visit them. And I remember there loaned me a book by Hugh Nibley, An Approach to the Book of Mormon. I hadn't read Nibley before, amazingly enough. And I took it home for a P-Day, and I thought, well, I'll just take it to the bathtub and I'll read the interesting chapters.
I think a lot of missionaries probably are introduced to Nibley. I was first on my mission. I hadn't read much on that anyway.
Yeah, so I took the book to the bathtub, and is this old cast iron tub with cloth, the cloth feet and everything.
Right.
And I started reading, just bouncing from chapter to chapter, and I read the whole book. The water got cold. I couldn't tell. I didn't care. I was just so powerfully impressed. My mind was just expanding. And I just felt like here's this whole world of Book of Mormon stuff that I hadn't tuned into before. But it was important that I had an investigator had said to complained about the Book of Mormon about a year before. And he said, I just don't buy into this story of King Benjamin's discourse. He gives the talk and everyone's converted. He says, people aren't like that. Not everyone would make the covenant. They all wouldn't, do that. Some people wouldn't believe. And at the time, my best answer was, it was a good speech, which wasn't very good. I put it on a back burner. And when I read the chapter in there on ancient coronation stuff, it just really leapt out. Yeah, this is it. This is, it's a ritual.
Give her just a quick snapshot of what Nibley was talking about as far as how he put King Benjamin into the idea of a coronation ritual.
Yeah, that's that breakthrough chapter in that book. And it led to, there's that huge book that Farms put out on King Benjamin's discourse that, all kind of derived from that. But just seeing it as a ritual where it's a coronation. The king calls together all of the people, throughout all the land, which is come tomorrow, which means it's a small land. And Nibley pointed out that there's 36 things that happen in a coronation, and they happen in Benjamin's discourse in order. And the climax of it, you know, that this investigator was complaining about, you know, that everyone's converted. Well, then Nibley pointed out that as part of the coronation, the thing is the acclamatio, where everyone is supposed to all fall to the ground at the same time and all with one voice make the covenant, you know, to honor the king. And so it's in a ritual context, it all makes sense. This sort of thing, putting it in the right context, you'll see things you wouldn't have seen before. You know, I came back with this hunger to read everything of Nibley that I could find. But I had other questions too, and I started accumulating prophet tests. You know, first of all, I collected, was reading the, especially the Bible, for as many tests for true prophets as I could find. And, you know, I come up with about 28. True and false, they're all neatly paired, so they're very easy to use. And I thought, well, this just makes it more obvious to me without explaining why it isn't obvious to the people I'm trying to convince. And I realized I've got all these tests, and anyone can look at them and say, so what? Well, what else is going on? You know, it's not just what we're looking at. Right. So then I studied a bunch of reasons why, well, what are you supposed to do to see truth? And I collected references on this, you know, and I thought these are interesting. They're saying, you know, you're supposed to be interested. And how often did we hear not interested, you know? And it's how you investigate. Are you seeking to make a man an offender, or are you trying to find out whether things are so? So the attitude and the actions of the investigators makes a difference. And that helped. But then I started looking at the things in the Bible where people were justifying rejecting a biblical prophet. And this is where I had another, you know, breakthrough. I collected about 70 of these, and I realized that I was hearing all of these still. It's, you know, it brought the Bible to life for me because I realized all of this stuff was still going on. And then if you put together the list of arguments for rejecting next to the tests, I realized that we're looking at the same person and seeing something very different. You know, one will say, gee, he's got pretty eyes, and another one say, yeah, I don't like his nose, he's really ugly. And it's of the things that there are to look at, they're noticing and valuing different things. You know, this is an expression from Ian Barber. So I started thinking I could write an article about this, and I spent a few years trying and actually sent something to the Ensign, which did not work out. I was explaining this out to my sister-in-law, and she said I needed to read The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Uh-huh. So I went out and got a copy of that, and then, you know, my copy is extremely dog-eared. So I've used it a lot. And because I realized I was seeing, you know, I was experiencing in the Bible the same thing Kuhn was talking about. And later, when I was getting my English degree, I actually wrote a paper called The Structure of Poetic Revolutions, where I looked at Wordsworth's introduction to the 1805 lyrical ballads, you know, and I noticed that Wordsworth was appealing to the same values that Kuhn talks about in deciding on a paradigm. He's trying to sell a new kind of poetry, so we should change the kind of poetry we're using. He's appealing to the same values that Kuhn was talking about. When I read Walt Whitman's preface to the 1856 Leaves of Grass, he's also appealing to the same values. So it's not a philosophical thing. It's a human pragmatic approach to deciding between paradigms. And I find that if I'm aware of that, then it helps me ask fruitful questions.
What did you end up doing? So you got home from your mission, and as far as a career, I understand you're a technical writer.
Yeah, I'm a technical writer. Now, I kind of wandered around for a while. I suffered from inappropriate role models for my personality type. For a while I was trying to go into business, and that just didn't work for me. I thought about being a teacher, that didn't work for me. I thought about going into classical guitar, and I ran into my limits as a musician. But at one point I got very obsessed with science fiction, and I wrote two science fiction stories and sold them twice each within a period of 2 weeks. And I met Orson Scott Card, you know, at that point, and sold him a story. And I thought maybe I'll be a science fiction writer. That didn't work. I'd been working construction for a while, and there was a recession back then, and that bottomed out. But I owe my career to my wife, who grew up and graduated from high school in San Jose, and she had a friend in San Jose who was a technical writer. And Shauna called up her friend and found out about a certificate program in technical writing out there, and told me about it, and we just knelt down and prayed. This was in November of 82. We knelt down and prayed together, and looked at each other and we both felt like it was the right move. And on December 31st, we up and left Utah and went off to California, neither of us having a job. You know, we were going out there like Okies. We actually had some furniture tied to the back of the U-Haul van, you know, that it wouldn't fit inside. And eventually I got started in tech writing out there. And my actual professional career didn't start until I was 30, but I've been doing it now for like 25 years, 26 years now.
And that's interesting. When did you get involved with publishing in Mormon studies? Because I know you've written things for in Dialogue or in Sunstone and also in the Farms Review. How did you get into publishing in those venues?
Well, the first thing that I did was for Dialogue. And that actually was connected to with the only crisis of faith I've ever had.
Let's talk about that.
It was an essay in Dialogue. And, I was getting into Nibley, and also, you know, when I was at the University of Utah, I'd go through the stacks, and I'd read back issues of BYU Studies and Dialogue and whatever I could find there, and I'd track down all the Nibley I could find. And this was, you know, in the period just up to when Farms was starting. But I got this article in Dialogue by Anthony Hutchinson comparing the creation accounts. And so he's looking at the differences between Genesis, Moses, Abraham, and the temple. And his conclusion was this, you know, that... You showed that there's no God or anything, and that we're all supposed to get through life, you know, find some meaning, however fleeting we can. It struck me as really depressing, and I didn't have an answer for what I was reading.
Didn't he basically say they were all mythical, right? Completely
yeah,
mythical.
Says, and yeah, no. And he's saying like Joseph Smith is just expanding in the seams between the, you know, the J and the P accounts and things, and he's not seeing any inspiration whatsoever.
Okay.
But in the article... the thing that really saved me is in the article, he had a diagram of the Hebrew cosmos. And you occasionally see this, and it's this very literalized view of you've got the firmament, you know, which is this rigid firmament above, and there's windows in it, and there's the waters above, and then there's the four pillars of heaven, and then there's the flat earth, and then there's the waters beneath. And they'll say, this is how the ancient Hebrews envisioned the cosmos.
Right.
And I was looking at that picture. This is like the third day after I'd read the essay, just kind of trying to, you know, how am I going to deal with this stuff? And I thought, I've seen this image somewhere before. Where was it? And then it comes to me. I'd read Hamlet's Mill because I'd seen Hamlet's Mill referred to in Nibley's articles. And I went pulled out my Hamlet's Mill and I found the passage where it's talking about archaic cosmology. And this literalized image... that we see the diagram, and people still publish it and say, this is really, you know, what the Hebrews believe, that the language in Hamlet's Mill talks about this flat earth in the period, this section of the sky through which the planets move, and above it there they would conceive waters above, and beneath it the waters beneath.
And that's where they say the floodwaters came from there,
yeah.
Right?
And so... And then they also have the idea of that there's one, you know, they knew about the precession of the equinoxes and that there's one star, you know, that in the rudder of Canopus, that their name for was Kalabadama, you know, the heart of the south, Kala,
right.
You know, that which of course resonates with. And that sort of, for me, it just opened up the sense that underneath and beneath and behind what we have in Genesis, there's something else. And that something else touches what we have in the book of Abraham, you know, so I wrote the article that appeared in Dialogue, and I actually sent it off to them, and I didn't hear for such a long time that I'd forgotten that I'd written it. And that came back, and I revised it and sent it to them, and one of the editors thanked me for writing it, because she said she'd been having problems with the essay too, and thanked me for what I'd written, so I felt like, you know, I've done something worthwhile. But around that time, see, Farms was starting up, and I was reading all of the Farms essays that I could. And then at one point, there was a notification about the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies. And I'd just been assembling an article for a Sunstone presentation on the Book of Mormon and Near-Death Experience Research. And I sent that, and it was published. And I'd read the Roberts study when it came out, and then later...
You're talking about B.H. Roberts?
Yeah, yeah. And I then when Vogel's book on Indian Origins and the Book of Mormon came out, I thought, you know, this is, I got Indian Origins and the Book of Mormon and read that, thinking, well, let's bring things up to date. And, of course, I saw issues with that, and I wrote a review of that.
So this is a book that Dan, the book Dan Vogel wrote about, basically sort of situating the Book of Mormon in 19th century Indian lore and things like that, correct? Okay.
And so I did a long review of that on my Atari ST, and sent that off to Farms when it's published, and the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies article was published, and then later I responded to a Sunstone article, and, you know, just eventually I had five or six, you know, the first five or six things I sent to Farms were all published. Really getting into apologetics is just, I'd done a lot of reading, and every once in a while discovered I had something to say. And there's two kinds of things where there'd be a reaction to something that I was reading and wanted to do a defense of the faith. And it's where I'd get wound up about something that I'd read and just work on it until I, you know, an article came out. Or like in the case of the near-death experience research where I just saw a connection and I realized, oh, yeah, Alma, nigh unto death. That's when his conversion was. The books that I was reading made me think about what I was reading, especially like Carol Zaleski's book, Other World Journeys. And I started seeing things in the Book of Mormon that I'd never seen before. And I felt like that's, you know, I still feel like that was a real good article. I'm very pleased with what I learned in writing it.
Now, I want to talk to you about a book that came out a while ago. It was edited by Brent Metcalf called New Approaches to the Book of Mormon.
Yes.
And this is a book that had some interesting essays about the Book of Mormon and sort of, for the most part, argued that the Book of Mormon was a 19th century text.
Yes.
And you read this book and you wrote a response to it. And an interesting quote that stuck out to me from the beginning of your article there is that you said, believing Mormons, particularly non-specialists, can deal constructively with this kind of book. You didn't want people to be afraid of those types of books, but that that they might be able to respond to them, even as a non-specialist.
Yeah.
And so what do you see as the role of an amateur in publishing in Mormon studies generally?
Well, Nibley said, he wrote an article on publishing. He said, if you write something that's original, authentic, and significant, it will get published. One thing, as an amateur, we just want to be informed. You know, I mean, basically, I didn't start out wanting to publish. I started out wanting to be informed.
Right.
And just eventually, on occasion, I'd find out that I had something to say that was that I recognized myself. Oh, this is original, authentic, and significant. You know, I wasn't thinking in those terms, but, you know, looking back, that's what happened. You know, in the case of New Approaches, you know, I was living in California then, and I went to Salt Lake and I saw the book. You know, I'd heard about it coming on, you know, the Mormon Underground. And there it was, and it was like wrapped in plastic, like it was radioactive and dangerous. And I brought it home, and I went to work the next day, and I walked into the office. I was working for a company called Zycat at this time, and I heard my boss say, I haven't seen him come in yet. And I thought, uh-oh. Well, they were having a, you know, a bit of a cutback, so I got laid off. So I had lots of time on my hands, and I started reading the book. And by the time I was... I'd read it and then realized I'm going to review this thing. And I was writing. And, you know, I was working about 14 hours a day on this. And after a couple of months, I looked at my wife and I said, honey, I think I'm doing something important. And I think when I'm done, I'll have a job. And that's exactly what happened.
It's interesting because in that review, you said opponents in the debates about Mormon history and scripture typically criticize each other for having preconceptions and methods that influence their approach to the evidence. The current debate needs discussion of the means by which we decide why one set of assumptions and methods should be preferred over another. So you're sort of contextualizing it in how people approach the issue itself, and you bring in the idea of a paradigm. And this is something that I believe you mentioned Thomas Kuhn. Who is Thomas Kuhn?
Yeah, Thomas Kuhn is a philosopher of science who in 1959 wrote and published a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And then there's, you know, a second edition in 1961 and a third edition, which I don't have. But this was like the culmination of a criticism of positivism and empiricism, where these guys just thinking, well, just look at the data and put it in our brains, which is a truth machine. We turn it, and the, you know, the unadulterated truth comes out. The data speaks for itself. You know, well, I saw a bumper sticker that there's a fundamentalist bumper sticker that says, "God said it, I believe it, that settles it." And I realized positivism is basically saying the data set, it, experiments proved it, that settles it. You know, like, it's all final, it's all a done deal.
Sure.
But they're realizing that that all data is theory laden. Nothing has any meaning outside of the framework.
That isn't to say that that Kuhn isn't saying, well, science is utterly flawed here. I mean, Kuhn is a philosopher of science.
Right.
This is what
yes.
he does.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So what was his idea of a paradigm? We're going to bring this back into how it applies to the Book of Mormon, but give us an idea
yeah.
of what a paradigm was, according to Kuhn.
Well, he says a paradigm is defined by standard examples of scientific work. You know, someone will come along, say like Newton, and will write and come up with a model of how things work, and it will impress people enough that they'll say, yes, we're going to use this. This is how things work. We're going to work within this framework. We're going to consider science as like he uses it's a puzzle, and we're going to play the game according to the rules. We're going to, these are the pieces. This is the chessboard. This is how the puzzle is set up. And if everyone agrees on the same set of rules, you can make a lot of progress over a period of time, but eventually what happens is you start running against the pieces that don't fit. The important thing is to pay attention to what are the standard examples that people use. When they start generalizing from something, what example are they going to generalize from? And we get this from, in anti-Mormon literature, there's a certain set of tropes. We're going to generalize about Joseph Smith. Well, he's a money digger, which makes him a con man. That's the framework. And you look at everything as though he's a liar. That colors everything. Not only
right.
colors everything, it tells you what you're going to notice and what you're going to value and what you see.
Right, and they'd say likewise, if you approach him as a prophet, it can help dictate the way
yeah.
that you interpret what you see in the record there.
Yeah, so then you have competing frameworks, and so then the tricky bit is, how do you decide which one is better? And in Kuhn's book is the thing that I found, aside from explaining how paradigms work, is the chapters where he talks about, okay, you start to have problems that you can't solve within the paradigm, and things start to get kludgy and complicated, and then there's a loosening of rules, and then you've got some mavericks out at the side that start saying, well, maybe this will work better. And so Einstein comes along and with relativity, and he says, this is going to be better, a better paradigm than what Newton had. And he also wants to be able to also explain why Newton's paradigm was as successful as it was. And so there's these kinds of arguments that they're saying accuracy of key predictions is one, I kind of summarized it. It's going to make certain predictions and will be reliable and accurate, and it will be comprehensive in its explanation. You'll have different fields of knowledge that it's going to bind together, and it'll be coherent. All of these bits will fit together. It will be fruitful. That is, you try it on for size, you get inside it, and you find out that you discover things that otherwise you never would have seen. The simplicity and aesthetics of it, that it just makes sense. His example is, when he talks about the thing with Copernicus, is that it wasn't as accurate as Ptolemaic astronomy, but it was so much simpler. That
right.
it held enough promise, at least, say, until Kepler comes along, and Kepler revises. Copernicus had the idea of circular orbits, which made it less accurate, but then the elliptical orbits made it more accurate. And then the new paradigm says, yeah, let's go for this. So there's also future promise. And one thing that I realized just recently I hadn't been emphasizing enough is the idea that it's something that's testable, that you can generate puzzles. You can if you have an idea for how things work, but there's no way to test it, it's not a very good paradigm to work in. It's just kind of sitting there.
So you've basically sort of outlined what a paradigm is, and there's a problem that Kuhn brings up where paradigms can't be particularly verified with certainty, and he gives two reasons. The first being that future discoveries can conflict with what the present theory is. And the second
yeah.
one is that another theory might explain present evidence equally well. And so
right.
when they're sort of running into each other, that's sort of what your response to the New Approaches book was. Now, so how did you take Kuhn and then apply it to this discussion about the Book of Mormon?
It's just those kind of questions about what a paradigm is. And for each of the articles that I went through, I could find out, what are they generalizing from? And what are they saying? This is the most significant thing. So I could say, okay, what accurate predictions are they making? Are they accurate? How comprehensive and coherent is their explanation? The example in my article that I still think is very good is the idea of trying to explain King Benjamin's discourse as a revival.
Right.
Well, that, you know, and so Metcalf comes on when he has this four-stage thing, which really I don't think fits very well. He's got some weird language.
It's interesting. He'll say, look, this this experience with King Benjamin sort of mirrors what we're seeing in 19th century revivals, where you've got people gathered and they fall to the ground. And so he does try to find a couple of things that do seem to fit in that 19th century. But you say there's a different paradigm. If you place it in the background of what Nibley was talking about with the coronation thing, you're saying that tends to bring better results. It makes sense of more of the data. Is that...
Yeah, it's more comprehensive. It's more coherent. There's, you know, if you read the book on Benjamin's Discourse, you know, it's not just Nibley's on the coronation, you know, that come along later. John Twetness' article on the Feast of the Tabernacles, there's especially the article by John Welch and Zink on the festival patterns, where it's Day of Atonement, where it's also Feast of Tabernacles, a Jubilee year, a Sabbath year, all of this combined at once, plus the background being that in the pre-exilic Israel, all of those separate festivals were combined in one, as they are in Benjamin's Discourse. And then, you know, since I've written my article, there's been things pointing out a Mesoamerican context for this, like the San Bartolome murals, which are contemporary with the account of King Benjamin, and within, you know, a couple hundred miles of where it was, where they show the coronation on the tower, and there's the creation themes and everything. So it looks very good as a Mesoamerican event.
Okay,
so it's a matter of weighing things. You can put it on either side, and someone, you know, say, well, since there is no God, none of your evidence counts. But that's not dealing with that specific, you know, criteria. Is it more, you know, the accuracy of the predictions? Is it comprehensive and coherent? You know, how much does it explain? Well, you know, Nibley's has a 36-step pattern. Metcalf gives a 4-step pattern. 36 is more than 4.
Right.
And there's more going on besides that, you know, the chiasmus and everything else. And also actually having something to say, you know, to have a discourse, okay, here's this pattern, but is it meaningful? Does it touch people's lives?
One criticism I've heard about the paradigms thing is people try to say that you're being sort of relativistic, that you're taking some sort of relativistic approach to truth that Kuhn would disagree with. Have you heard that at all?
I just actually got that the other day from Dan Vogel.
Yeah, I mean, what do you say to that?
I've answered him at length on that. I don't think he understands Kuhn at all. To call it relativistic is silly. I mean, as long as, you know, Kuhn is able to say it makes a great deal of sense to be able to ask which paradigm is better, as long as you have some criteria that are not paradigm dependent, where it's, you can actually give it reasons, not necessarily that everyone will accept them, but that you do have reasons for your paradigm.
Yeah.
You know, that you can say it's these predictions are more accurate, and I think these are important ones for a while. You know, it's more comprehensive and coherent. It's fruitful. I'm finding things that I never would have seen otherwise. It's simpler, and it's the future promises there. If I can make those kind of arguments, then I'm giving reasons for my belief, and it's not, I'm just saying, well, it's because it's orthodox.
Right.
You know, it's this authority figure, or it's that authority figure. It's, you know, I'm not just saying it's because it's the Orthodox religion. A lot of times, when you're aware of that, if someone is arguing, you know, like, you know, Kevin's wrong because of this label, or Kevin's wrong because of, you know, relativistic, that's really applying labels, you know. Well, back it up. If you're going to say I'm relativistic, you know, where's the evidence? And there isn't any. His attempt, I guess, once in Sunstone and once on his website to try and dismiss what I was doing. So I feel like I've responded to him at length and in detail in the Sunstone essay and in the Farms Review in 16.1. I feel like I've, you know, answered that. To call it what they're trying to, they're upset that they can't force people to believe what they believe. You know, they just want to be able to say, I've taken this data and I've laid it out in front of you and it speaks for itself. You know, I've just applied objectivity and reason and this comes out, and you shouldn't be able to disagree.
Well, he would say naturalism, right? That's his whole...
Yeah. And, well, I still think the best conversation I had ever had with Vogel was when somebody said... it was on the other board, I think on ZLMB a few years ago. Someone said, were you disappointed with the response to new approaches? And he said, no, we had no illusions about the impact of a single book. And I piped in, the Book of Mormon was a single book. You know, he got really upset about that. And he said, no, there's not the same thing at all. Because, the church has all of this, massive media empire and all these missionaries and all of this. And I said, yeah, but in 1830, the missionary program was Samuel Smith and a knapsack. And it was a single book that made the difference.
Right.
It's been longer now since New Approaches was published. That's the time that Joseph Smith had before he was killed.
Another quality that you bring up in your discussion of going through criticisms of the Book of Mormon or whatever, or just dealing with a difficult issue of your own faith, you bring up the characteristic of humility. And can you situate that idea within an academic approach to the Book of Mormon or to Mormon studies? How does the characteristic of humility play into it?
Pride, just look back in the past, when like Alexander Campbell, who wrote one of the first responses to the Book of Mormon, and he's going to take on Joseph Smith and take his measure. It's a done deal. This is all you need to know about Joseph Smith. And you read that nowadays, and it's silly. Same thing with the Roberts study. You read that now. John Welch wrote his paper in 1985 answering all of B.H. Roberts' questions, and I did this other article on Bill Russell's thing. And just seeing as time goes by, things look bad, and there's just this sense. I think we have to approach it with the sense of being tentative. Nibley talked about the gas law of learning, that any amount of information will expand to fill any intellectual void, no matter how large. And, as an amateur scholar, I'm, outside of the university, and I don't do my work in libraries. I do it, just sitting here with my own books spread around me. And I'm acutely aware of my limitations, in language and things. And in most cases, I wouldn't dare publish unless I just had the sense that, well, here I'm making a contribution. I'm not an important guy. I'm just, a small fry. I'm a spear carrier here. But, I found this gem, and it's pretty. I think it's solid, and I like to get published in peer-reviewed journals because, I'm a little insecure. I want to have somebody who knows more than me look at it and say, yeah, this is good.
That's you bring up being published in peer-reviewed journals, but you're also part of a compilation that Reed Nelson and Terrell Givens edited that came out, I believe, in last year or the year before.
Yeah, it was last year.
Yeah, Joseph Smith Jr., Reappraisals After Two Centuries. In that essay, you bring up the idea of humility indirectly. I don't know if you use that same word, but you bring it up in the context of the way that Mormons read the Revelations. And you're basically saying that people that say, oh, Mormons today, you can't read the Book of Mormon that way because so-and-so read it differently than you back in the past.
Yeah.
B.H. Roberts saw it this way, so you should be tied, you should be tied to his feeling. Talk about that, about the way that the Mormon community itself, the understanding of the Book of Mormon can change over time.
Yeah, well, this is with any community. It's Kuhn talks about one of the things that supports the paradigm when people say, this is why I belong to this paradigm because of the prestige of my teacher. Says that's one of the reasons. But if I look at that, it's basically, I'm a technical writer in the electronics engineering industry. And in electronical engineering, hierarchy is a method for dealing with complexity in a design. And it's also, I notice, it's a way of dealing with complexity here. We have, there's a book that in Mormon circles I like to refer to as the Big Book of What to Think. You know who I'm talking about. I won't be specific.
No, but what? Well,
yeah.
No, who is it?
The Elder McConkie's book, Mormon Doctrine.
Yes.
A Big Book of What to Think.
Well, just well, it just gives you the answers, right?
And so here we have all of this information. It's far too much for any one of us to handle. But if we can look at somebody, and for somebody like me, it can be, when I first discovered Nibley, this is so exciting.
Right.
Or there's an authority figure who seems to know what he's doing, and he's got the big book out there. And this thing, there's the assumption always, he's a black box. And he's processed all this information, and truth comes out.
And he's talking about things that a lot of other general authorities, frankly, aren't. I mean, he tried to cover things that that other people hadn't really talked about. So I think there was that novelty factor as well.
Yeah. So, but thinking about hierarchy as a way of dealing with complexity, I might be using the hierarchy to deal with the complexity, but I can always look inside the box and say, well, what's going on inside the box? And the questions, you know, that we can ask of any boxes, you know, is instead of the one, well, it's he's an authority figure, say, the questions that Kuhn asks about paradigms, you know, is it comprehensive and coherent? What are the predictions that it makes? How accurate is it? Is it fruitful? What happens if you try something else? Will you see stuff that you never would have seen otherwise? How much promise is there in this? And I find by asking those kind of questions, it's very helpful. Plus, the other things I did in the Paradigms Regained, I noticed that everybody is selective. What, you know, what are people selecting? What are they leaving out? Everybody puts things in the context. Would another context be more telling?
Right. It's. I mean, it's sort of inevitable. In order to grasp something, we do have to make a selection, and we do have to associate it with something.
And there's always room to ask those questions about everybody.
Along with that, you've talked about the Book of Mormon as being based on in real ancient history, or as being inspired fiction. And Anthony Hutchinson, you mentioned his essay earlier about the creation accounts. This is a quote from him. He says, "We need to stop talking about the Book of Mormon's antiquity and begin reading its stories, considering how early Mormons would have understood them and relating their context to our own." And you agreed that it's interesting to look at the stories. It's great to look at how early Mormons understood the way that, you know, how they understood the text can be important to us. We can also liken it to ourselves without really worrying about that. But you find the idea of the Book of Mormon as being an actual ancient record, you find that more appealing, and we've given some reasons here.
Yeah.
But you also, it's interesting to me that you also leave a little bit of room for people who maybe don't see it that way. And can you talk a little bit about that as far as people who find a lot of relevance in the Book of Mormon, even aside from those particular questions of antiquity?
Yeah. Well, when Alma talks about, he says, "I know that you can't believe all of my words, but if you can give place to even a portion of my words, if you have no more than a desire to believe." And that portion can be that kind of reading. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I'm all for it, because I think the Book of Mormon does have things to say. And there are things that I think are fiction, you know, like King Lear. You know, I think King Lear is the greatest theodicy ever written. I think it's better than the Book of Job in terms of talking about dealing with the questions of, you know, the existence of, you know, unpleasant experiences in our lives and how, you know, what that means. It's like it's an inversion of Jesus's parable. What profiteth the man if he gain the whole world but lose his soul? And Lear turns that upside down. It shows a man who has the world and loses it all, but he gains his soul.
Right.
You know, it has a truth, because it's not pure fiction, because it's pointing towards something real. And this is what I got from Joseph Campbell's books on mythology, is that the myths have power because they are pointing to something real.
That's actually appealed to C.S. Lewis as well. That's sort of some of the reasoning that brought him from atheism to belief in God. Here's a really interesting quote from you, and I want to get your reaction to it. It was you. Here's Kevin Christensen on Kevin Christensen. Here we go. You said, "The message of the Book of Mormon is sufficiently relevant to contemporary life that it should be possible for a person to read it for the purpose of likening it to ourselves without being concerned about historicity." I'd sort of like to hear you react to that.
Well, there's things in it like I say, Alma 32 is this discussion of how to have faith. You know, it's just as true applying it to any real life as it is to think, well, what's the historicity of it? You know, I went down to the I saw a Tree of Life conference down at BYU, where Alan Christensen was showing this Mesoamerican picture of a Mesoamerican art showing a tree growing out of someone's chest. Well, I mean, that's very interesting in terms of historicity, but you don't need that to appreciate Alma 32. You don't need, and there are other stories in the Book of Mormon, you know, I will go and do the thing that the Lord commanded, I know we'll prepare a way for you, or say the opposition and all things. All of these things, little stories like that, that can be relevant. Scott Card wrote 5 science fiction novels using the plot of the Book of Mormon up to Alma.
Sure.
And you can appreciate those without caring that their Book of Mormon is behind it. You know, that there is something dramatic and human there. And I was very impressed with Alan Goff's work on type scenes. You know, that changed the way that I read the Book of Mormon, and just seeing, you know, the way that the type scenes work. Someone wrote an essay looking, say, at Nephi's the story of Nephi in light of Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces. You know, so that the hero pattern that Nephi goes through, you can read it just as you would a myth, because the mythic pattern is there.
Right.
And for you, the myths tell us how to live a human life.
Right, and it's interesting because, as we've talked about, for you, antiquity is still, for you, an important aspect of the Book of Mormon. And why is that?
Because what is real is binding. That's part of it. And the other thing is I see more in the Book of Mormon when I read it as an ancient book. You know, I see things that I never would have seen otherwise. You know, I'd read the Book of Mormon, you know, before I'd read Nibley's book, I'd read the Book of Mormon probably 5 or 6 times, and never being able to do anything but likening it to myself. You know, reading the proof text and the stories and things, and but when I read Nibley, I realized that there's stuff going on that I had no idea was there. And then later, when I read Sorensen's work and Brant Gardner's work and Larry Polson's, there's this sense of I just see far more in it. And whenever I get the sense that it's real, I'm very much aware that it's not only real, but it's because it's real, it's binding.
Let's talk about background expectations. This sort of returns to Kuhn and the way we approach different questions. We approach questions and problems with background expectations. And yeah. I want to talk to you about the role of doubt and faith in religion. To bring up an old couple, there's Harold and Sandra Tanner. Mm-hmm. They sort of made a career out of unsettling people based on the background expectations for perfection, or that Mormonism, yeah, if it changes at all, that's a huge problem. Talk a little bit about your feelings about those sort of expectations that people might bring to the table.
The most important thing is that I realize that if you insist on perfection, by definition, you've made imperfection decisive, and only imperfection is decisive. So when that's the question, that's going to shape what you're looking for. You know, as look at Joseph Smith and say, is Joseph Smith perfect? Well, no matter how much good he did, that's not going to answer whether he's perfect. But if there's a flaw, if there's any flaw, then I can, you know, be done with them. You know, and anything that even looks bad, it doesn't even matter whether it is bad. If just because when I've decided to judge someone against that standard, I'm also assuming that I'm capable of making that judgment. And of course, I think that's nonsense, you know, because I've been wrong about so much that I, you know, tend to want to slow down a bit.
It's funny because in the church, we talk a lot about certainty. We want to say that we know, that's sort of something you might hear a lot in sacrament meeting. But you've talked about that there can also be sort of a danger there if you want to know something with finality and not to keep seeking. What sort of problems might crop up if you have that perspective?
Well, just because you don't ask questions, if you think that we have all of the truth on the shelf and there's nothing more to learn, it's just all there, and you're just not prepared when something comes up that you didn't expect. And I think Alma talks about it in Alma 32. He makes a contrast between those who know, you know, they want to find, you know, they want to have a miracle, they want to be forced to believe, you know, they have secular authority say, okay, it's all official, it's all, you know, in the bank, you can count on this, or those who just have cause to believe, because cause to believe is open-ended. You know, you say, these are the reasons why I have faith, but it doesn't mean that I know everything. You know, when Alma says, you know, after you've experienced the growing of the seed, he says, is your knowledge perfect? I say unto you, and then you're expecting him to say yes, but he says nay. Your knowledge is not perfect. And
right.
I've embraced that because it gives me this sense of, you know, that there's more to learn. That I can take shocks. I can, you know, find out about things I didn't know about and just think, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Instead of shattering. I once wrote in one of my classes, I used the image a teacher liked. I said it was as though a crystal tornado coughed. You have all of this energy and then just jarred and then shattering to pieces. And I've seen this quite often. And, you know, you hear people come in and tell their stories that, you know, I was a believing Mormon, la, 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 la. And then I ran across this information about, you know, whatever happens to be polyandry and this, something like that. And that's it. And that's all they care about. They found the imperfection. And I use this quote from Betty Edwards' book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, a lot because it ties in. Imperfection being decisive is important. And Betty Edwards points out, just in dealing with art, that our brains are wired so that the things that we think are important, we see as larger than they actually are. They seem to convey more information, so our brain actually makes them bigger in our head. And so if we drop that standard of expecting perfection and say something different, my thing is it real? If I'm saying, is Joseph Smith's inspiration real, is a very different question than saying, is Joseph Smith's inspiration perfect? It points me in a completely different direction. The whole, it's a much broader thing to look at, and right. It makes me work a lot harder.
You've brought this up in tandem with Joseph Smith's quote, where he talked about creeds. The problem that he had with creeds is that they set up stakes and they say you come this far and you don't come any further. And then as soon as something comes along that sort of disagrees with that, you fly to pieces like glass. So, what would your advice be then, as far as people who want to have confidence in God, but might have doubts and things like that?
I think, ask what is real instead of what's perfect. Because we can see things that are real, that are definitely real. There's real power in spiritual experience. There's things that we can find in scholarship. The story that I told in my dialogue article was when I was a kid, when I was like 4 or 5 years old, almost as young as I can remember anything, we went to the Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry in southern Utah. And at this point, there was no improved roads. We just went out there and it's all, just desert and gullies and, car bumping and kicking up dust behind, and there's rocks clinking off the bottom. And we get out there and there's no museum or anything. There's just a couple of, paleontologists, a couple of students out there, and they're working with dental tools and brushes on the rock. And I'm just a little boy, but I can look and see the rocks, and the rocks, they're bones. And I know the bones are real. So over the years, I read all sorts of stuff about dinosaurs, and most of the stuff that I learned for the first 20 years was wrong. But that doesn't change the fact that the bones are real.
The things you learned as far as like the age of the earth or...
Yeah. Well, just... that could be a separate question. Just the fact that here's something real that I'm going to, no matter what else changes, I talked about when I was a kid, the brontosaurus was the dinosaur. Well, there's no such thing. It turned out that an over-eager fossil hunter put the wrong head on the skeleton.
Right.
And also they figured out, these things are worm-blooded. They didn't drag their tails. They carried their tails. Weren't in water. They had pine needles. Everything about the sociology, about their behavior changes except the fact that the bones are real. It's just the sense of something's real. If I asked if his inspiration is real, I can look at the Book of Mormon and find all sorts of real things, or look at his discourses and find all sorts of things that are real. And I can compare what I get from him from other people and, say I read the story of, Animal 36, and I did the paper on near-death stuff compared to Animal 36 and realized, Joseph Smith's inspiration is real. That doesn't answer every question. It doesn't solve every problem. But there's something going on. There's something, for me, it's evidence that there's a reality behind this. And it's a separate question from perfection. And so I can't measure up to perfection. I couldn't judge it anyway. But I can ask if something is real. And as I pursue that, it's going to grow and grow and grow. And while it's growing, say it's not, a seed just doesn't turn into a much bigger seed without changing shape. And as my understanding of Mormonism grows, it changes for me. What I see in the church now, what I see in Joseph Smith, what I see in myself and my family and everything else is a growing thing, and I think there should be room to grow. But if we think we have truth on the shelf, then there's no room to grow, and we can't take shocks.
Right. There's a chapter in a book I read on my mission. It's a book of sermons by Henry B. Eyring, and it's called Helping a Student in a Moment of Doubt, something along those lines. And he says that part of the response to people who come to him with doubts would be to point out that can be a positive thing. That's sort of a continuation of the Mormon view of the war in heaven, where we have agency and we're trying to think for ourselves and make conscious and good decisions. I've seen you sort of argue for a fruitful place for doubt even within religious faith. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that as well.
Well, just realizing if we don't know everything, then there's room, I think, for a bit more tolerance. To listen to each other instead of thinking that we all know everything, there's room to appreciate more what other people have.
It's interesting because you take a canonical scripture, you take a scripture from the Doctrine and Covenants that seems to argue differently, and you sort of turn it on its head. I'm referring to Doctrine and Covenants section 1, where it talks about the church, and it says it's the only true and living church. And, and you argue
that
yeah, that you say that section actually puts forth a Mormonism that's, and this is a quote from you, you said, it's incomplete, socially imperfect, and non-exclusive with respect to truth and virtue. So in other words, that it teaches that, you know, you don't have to be Mormon to be good, and there are truths that other people have, even if they're not Mormon. So go ahead and talk about that.
Okay. Well, this started, Nibley said, every anomaly is a hint that there's something that we don't know. This is before Adam talk. That's not an exact quote. The idea that something doesn't seem to fit, that's where the new information is. And I'd be reading D&C 1, and I saw that and living hanging there. And I thought, every time I hear a testimony, they're saying it's only true. Well, what does the and living mean? And then I started looking, I'll look in the Bible. What are the places where you get and living, and living bread, tree of life, living waters, way of the truth and the life. There's one place in Jeremiah 10:10 where he talks about, I am the true God, I am the living God. But the Jeremiah passage is a voice of warning passage. And I started writing all of these references in my D&C, and I've got references all the way through it. And what I realized is that the passages that talk about, like, I am the true vine, that's a priesthood passage. Well, D&C 1 talks about priesthood. You know, the Jeremiah passage is a voice of warning. D&C 1 starts with a voice of warning. And so I see true and living as a merism. It's a way of taking the whole themes that D&C 1 talks about and wrapping them up together, saying this, you know, the only true and living church upon the face of the whole earth with which I, the Lord, am well pleased. Well, the only modifies, it doesn't say only true church, it says the only well-pleasing church relative to true and living criteria, which, you know, in the passages, like the living waters or the waters of baptism and sacrament and the tree of life and the covenants. So these things have to do with priesthood and ordinances and covenants and the temple and Revelation and the Book of Mormon. They have to do with the things that in actual day-by-day practice are what really does distinguish us from other people. We have the Book of Mormon. We have the temple. Nobody else does. And that's well-pleasing to God. But that doesn't mean that there aren't, you know, people like Margaret out there or Mother Teresa or whomever that are doing good and faithful work and that are believing, loving Christians and that we can learn from. You know, you mentioned, you know, the scholars that you're reading. It's just the sense that it's larger than we are and that we don't have to feel like, well, you know, because some people are, that's the thing that bothers them. You know, this, you know, they'll say only a small percentage of humanity is in the LDS church. Well,
right.
God is much bigger than that. You know, and Alma says God remembers the heathen, which I think is a remarkable passage.
It's sort of a funny passage, too, the way he phrases that.
Yeah. There's just this sense of it's very open and encompassing and recognizing that God is doing, you know, what he's doing everywhere with everybody. You know, and Joseph Smith talked about how people are judged according to what they don't have, but according to what they have. In the sense that Jesus knows us personally and individually and what our situation is, and it's that intimate at one knowledge with us that permits him to be able to judge us and also to help us.
Well, Kevin, we really appreciate you joining us here on the FAIR podcast tonight. And one more question that I have, are there any projects that you're working on right now, any articles you're putting together or...
I'm kind of between articles. There's, you know, I have an unfinished article on Jeremiah that I'm kind of stalled on. That's Half the Nation Changed Their Gods, where I'm looking at Jeremiah in light of Margaret's work on the Reform. But at the moment, I'm just, you know, trying to be a good husband, trying to be a good father, trying to be a good son, and be a good disciple of Christ. And when it's time for me to write something else, I think it's, you know, like everything else, it will grab me and shake me, and when it's through shaking me, there'll be another article.
What would your advice be to people who may not be looking into higher education in religious studies, but still want to pitch into the conversation?
Just get informed. The resources that we have at Fair and Farms and, you know, Jeff Lindsay's site and other things like that are remarkable. There's so much that you can get without having to do all the legwork that I used to have to do. It's amazing to just get informed and get interested and follow your own questions. And as you do that, then I think that's your best opportunity to help yourself and then put yourself in a situation to be able to help others.
All right. Thanks a lot, Kevin.
You're very welcome, Blair.
Thanks for listening to Fair Conversations. I'm Blair Hodges. I host Fair Conversations. This episode featured Kevin Christensen. You can check links and other information about some of the references Kevin mentioned in his interview on the Fair blog. You can also leave questions or comments there in the blog comments section, or send them to podcast@fairlds.org.